facts of it were we were in New York in, I think it was September 79. We were always already like the hottest band in the world. Everybody was after us. We were surrounded by photographers, lots of girl photographers. And somewhere in there, you know, I started to get interested in their equipment. I started looking at it all and thinking about it. Something occurred to me, oh, I should get a really good camera. I'm on the road. I've got all this time, you know. I mean, the only real commitment I have is getting the gig and playing, you know, a couple of hours.
Welcome to Behind the Setlist, the podcast where artists tell the stories about the songs they perform live. I'm Jay Gilbert from Label Logic.
And I'm Glenn Peoples from Billboard. In this episode, we talk to Andy Summers, the great guitarist with a surprisingly large body of work as a solo artist, in addition to the well-known recordings he has done with the Police and decades of touring history that goes along with such a luminous career.
Yeah, not only is he an accomplished, amazing guitarist, he's also a seasoned photographer. His recent book, A Series of Glances, covers several decades of his photos from travels all around the world and interaction with people from a lot of different cultures.
And, you know, photography really dominated, I would say, at least half of the conversation we had with Andy. Currently, he's combining his two passions in a tour called A Cracked Lens and A Missing String. And he's performing at theaters all around the country, doing solo guitar performance that complements his photography being projected onto a screen behind him. You can go to YouTube and watch videos of this stuff. It looks great. The set list includes renditions of some beloved Police songs, including Roxanne and Message in a Bottle, and then songs from his solo career, and covers of such artists as Brazilian guitarist Luiz Bonfa.
Yeah, you know, we asked him about his style of play because he doesn't sound like any other guitar player. And I think a lot of it is, you know, he grew up playing jazz guitar, later studied classical guitar at Cal State Northridge. And I mentioned to him that sometimes it's what you don't play, not just what you do play.
Yeah, and he learned that from, if memory serves, Miles Davis and other jazz musicians. You know, I think if people just know Andy from the Police, they'll be pleasantly surprised listening to the interview. And then do a little research on your own and learn about his solo work, learn about his photography, his numerous books out. Very interesting guy, accomplished in many different areas. And so it was a great conversation.
It really was. So now, without further ado, here's Andy Summers behind the set list. Let it roll. I'd love to sort of kick it off. There's so many things I want to talk to you about, whether it's photography and music and the songs that you choose. But I want to back up a little bit because listening to your music over the years, you don't sound like any other guitar player, not in popular music, not in rock. And I think there's a really good reason for that. And it's sort of your roots of playing jazz guitar and classical guitar. And talk about when you were younger and growing up, what were you listening to? Was it Django Reinhardt? Was it Wes Montgomery? Where did you sort of cut your teeth?
Well, of course, I knew all these people. Yeah, you know, because, of course, as I, you know, emerged from 11 years old and, you know, 6 years of piano playing, you know, they got onto the guitar and became, well, sort of unconsciously knew that this was my road ahead with life. Absolutely. You know, I never thought about anything else except guitar playing in those, you know, formative years. And, you know, so I was absorbing, listening to as much guitar playing I could. And, you know, one kid would know this thing, one kid would know that thing. You know, I grew up in Britain, and of course, sort of the dominant guitar thing was there with Cliff Richard and the Shadows. Hank Marvin was taking in a little bit of American influence. And, you know, we all wanted to be American and play like American guitar players at that time. And so, you know, you're starting out as a kid, you're getting through a C chord, then you finally got to D7, then you may go to the mighty E chord. You start sort of working your way through the first chords, which are all pretty folky kind of things, sort of basic guitar. And then, you know, if you have the ear for it or the talent, the innate talent, your ear starts getting to more sophisticated sounds. And that's when you move on. In my case, you know, I started out with all those guys like Big Bill Brunsey, you know, American players, you know, folk players, Lonnie Donegan, and start off playing the stuff that I could play. Then I started to get better and better. My hands started to, you know, have the ability. And then you start hearing, you know, altered chords and more jazzy chords. And then you hear somebody like Wes Montgomery and you go, oh my God. I remember trying to learn West Coast, the whole solo of West Coast Blues by Wes Montgomery at 15 years old. And I pretty much got it. But see, this was hugely influential because it was all about time, yeah. phrasing, altered yeah. notes over chords. You know, this is real musician stuff. But, you know, there I was at 15 years old trying to get all that. And most of it I did get. I didn't necessarily understand it because there's a lot of harmonic theory sophistication that you learn and get over time. So, you know, I was truly on the path to being, you know, what I would sort of ultimately become. But somewhere in all that, you know, there is this idea, this inkling that with all this material you now have, you must find your own way with it. You know, the watchword was, you must find your own voice. You must find your voice. And a lot of that is by deciding that you don't want to sound like this, you don't want to sound like that, you know, until you sort of boil it down to what pleases you, and then you sort of commit to that and try and make it into a style or a mode of playing, you know, which certainly was very much on my mind.
Yeah. I've noticed that it's not just what you play, it's what you don't play.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the big lessons. Yeah. You know, one of the, you know, things that you pick up as a kid, or at least I did when I was reading all those American downbeat jazz magazines, was, you know, the use of space. Of course, the great master of it was Miles Davis. He played all the wrong notes with a lot of space, and it was sublime. You know, it was brilliant. Sort of the opposite of Dizzy Gillespie, who was also incredible. But Miles was really the master of playing a few weird notes that didn't fit and made a great poetic statement. Yeah.
One song you've put in your set lists on this tour is Round Midnight by Thelonious Monk, and you did an album of his music. And at what point in your career did you hit on Thelonious Monk?
Well, actually, I was very lucky. When I was 16, I went to London to see, you know, I think it was like maybe a show called Jazz at the Philharmonic. Maybe. It was various American jazz artists. I think Dizzy Gillespie was on it. But notably on the show was Monk. I think he was playing solo piano, and of course, you know, I'd heard about him as I was starting to get the knowledge of music, and of course, it knocked me out. You know, it was just wonderful. It was so quirky and different than everybody else, so individual, and you know, he seemed to have the ability to play all these dissonances and so-called wrong notes to make a very individual, personal statement. That went a long way with me, and I became a, you know, lifelong Monk fan, of course, all that. And the truth is, you know, his music is not difficult. It's his tunes are very bright and cheerful. People go, oh, Monk, it's so difficult. It's not. It's almost not avant-garde. His tunes are really like little pop tunes, and then, of course, the way he plays around them is so brilliant. The absolute unique musical personality.
Yeah. So you studied classical guitar. And I find that fascinating because I don't know many classical guitarists. I mean, Andre Segovia jumps to mind. But what sort of things would you play? And was it just nylon string, acoustic? What was that?
Yeah. Well, I would, you know, we go through different phases in life. I found myself in Los Angeles and sort of, I'd been already been in bands for a long time. And I was so used to it, you know, and suddenly I've got this idea of, oh, classical guitar is the ultimate way to play the guitar. I was still pretty young, and I thought, oh, I've got to do that. And the only guitar I had was a little nylon string. This was the 40 days in the desert period. And, you know, I took up classical guitar, and I went to college for 4 years, studied classical guitar with a couple of people and learned vast repertoire on classical guitar. And, you know, I went through this for about 5 years or so. And then just one day, actually, it was because I got the Telecaster that I used in the police. There was such a transformative instrument. And I suddenly found myself back on the Telecaster. And I hooked up with a guy called Tim Rose, who was a pretty noted singer-songwriter at that time. Had a song called Morning Dew. And, you know, back I came, you know, and that's when I returned to the UK, back home. And, you know, got back into it. But I never lost my love for, you know, the classical instrument and the repertoire and all that. But it's a very hard thing to make a career mm-hmm. of. And, you know, I had all the chops and improvising and playability on the electric guitar. And, you know, I moved forward with that in a very different situation. Didn't work out, of course, but there you go.
And another thing you drop into your set is some Brazilian music. And talk about the Brazilian influence and what artists got you into Brazilian music.
Well, my introduction to Brazilian music and subsequent pointer in things I've done was when I was 15, 16, 17, I used to go to a place called the Continental Cinema in my hometown. And what they showed exclusively was European art house movies. And so I was completely fascinated by all these movies by, you know, like Truffaut, Bergman, Fellini, Agnes Varda, so on and so forth. It was like an education for me because it was all very alien outside of England and other languages and adult situations. But one of the films that I saw, it was a film called Black Orpheus, and this was the sort of Orpheus myth portrayed as if in Rio de Janeiro. And it had wonderful music, it had this wonderful song called Manhã de Carnaval by Luiz Bonfá. And it was a great tune, which I've subsequently learned. And there's some other great music in the film, also songs by Joe Beam. So this was a huge and very kind of exotic influence on me. That's where the love of Brazilian music. And I had that little period in Los Angeles, and I studied with a great, you know, Los Angeles guitar player called Howard Heitmeyer, who was also very into it. And he taught me a lot about Brazilian music and Brazilian tunes and how to play them on the guitar. And so, you know, it was a thing for me, you know, and of course I actually love Brazilian music. And, you know, of course, eventually I did go to Rio with the police, of course, but we played to massive places. And then I started sometime after the demise of the police, I got into a relationship with a great Brazilian, you know, producer, promoter down there. And, you know, I've subsequently been there every year since 95. I've never missed a year. Sometimes I've been three times a year. So it's like my other home is actually Brazil. And so all these things was, you know, sort of felt like they were meant to be in my life. It's amazing. I saw that at 16. And then I've had all these years of playing in Brazil and, you know, even playing that song like Manhã de Carnaval to thousands of people on the beach in Rio. And so I feel very blessed about that because I've, you know, half my career has been in, but not so much known in Europe or the West, but half of it's been in South America.
Yeah. And I've noticed that you did some dates there with this tribute band you put together, Call the Police, which sounds like a lot of fun. Tell us a little bit about how you put that together.
Well, it is. It is great fun, and it's a more recent development. And unfortunately, we got slightly stymied by the three-year absence because of COVID. Everything stopped in Brazil. Everything stopped everywhere. But I played in all sorts of incarnations in Brazil, guitar duos. I played with another Brazilian band. I played with an orchestra. I played with the great Brazilian bossa nova master. I've had a lot of exposure in Brazil. I'm pretty well known down there, as well as Argentina, Chile, and all the rest of it. I played there this year. We did a month there. Somewhere along the line later, you know, three or four years back, sort of pre-pandemic, the guy that I worked with got involved with a very good singer, bass player, guy called Rodrigo Santos, who's in a famous band called
The Red Baron?
Red Baron, sorry, thank you. Baron Vermejo. And we started playing together just very casually, not playing police at all. We did some of my songs, some of his songs. We did a couple of gigs around Rio and, you know, started sort of getting into a thing, you know, and we had another drummer who was very good. And then the producer guy, Luis Paulo, suggested that maybe we bring in this other drummer, very famous drummer from the João Baroni from the Paralamas, who have had endless hits in South America. They're very famous. And so now we had kind of a famous band. Yeah, I'm the guy from the Police. But, you know, we started off trying to do sort of a mixed show. But basically it came down to doing, you know, 12 hits of the Police, which is great fun for me and no shame whatsoever. This band is a kick-ass band and it's very loose. It's just a lot of fun. And, you know, we sell out everywhere we go. So,
awesome.
Yeah, wasn't expecting it, but there it is. And I'm going to go and play in September with them. We were supposed to play in Mexico a few months back. Anyway, there was a total visa problem. I ended up in Mexico alone. And
oh, no.
The other two guys couldn't make it. Anyway, that's all we sorted out. So we're doing what you would call postponed gigs. You know, we got four in Mexico in September, at the end of September. So I'm looking forward to meeting up with everybody. And then, yeah, there are a couple of sets of times next year down there. I think we'll do the northeast of Brazil, and then in the summer we'll probably do a bigger tour, yeah. Cool. It's fun. You know, it's great fun. You know, everything's a sellout. Everybody's crazy for it. It's all right, you know.
Your current tour, titled A Cracked Lens and a Missing String, has you playing guitar in a large screen showing your photography, and you're performing a lot of medium-sized venues around the country. Talk about how you came up with this idea for this particular type of mixed media performance.
Yeah, well, what's surprising to me is that I didn't do this years ago. Well, I did do it years ago. I was doing it actually pre-pandemic, but even then it was like late in the day. Man, you've been doing this for so long. And for some reason, I don't know why particularly, I sort of separated out doing, you know, like gallery shows, that sort of thing, and turning up. And yeah, it was very nice. Again, it was sort of like a gig, but, you know, I got totally into, you know, how to be a photographer, how to make prints, how to, you know, get the prints shipped to the place, how do you want to, you know, there's a whole other side to it, but no problem. And I've had a lot of success with it, including some big museum shows towards the pre-pandemic era. And now coming back to it, I don't know, somewhere along the line, I must have been, well, when I, around the time I started doing it, I guess it sort of came to me that maybe I did a video or something and I started using my own still photographs and sort of, you know, within what you can do with computers, of course, they're still photographs, but not really still. They're always morphing and moving, or the camera's drifting over the photograph. It's sort of modern technique. And it occurred to me that maybe I could put this together. So, I've gone into a long talk about it. You know, I've basically developed it and got this idea going. You know, I started off small. I started in LA one night. I did a show and it went really well. And, you know, then I did another one. Then I did about 11 shows. The last one I did prior to all this was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And it was sold out and it was a great show. But, you know, things change because as you do it more and more, you get more and more ideas. And I think we've actually developed it into quite a sophisticated place from that early start. And the way you learn, the way you do it is by actually doing it in front of an audience. I mean, you know, of course, I practice in my studio and we, you know, project onto a big white wall and I play. And then, you know, so that's your normal practice, sequencing, playing, getting used to it. Then you do it once in front of an audience and realize you've got everything wrong. And so you revise it and start putting it, you know, making a nice, cool moves on it. So it's always a work in progress.
Yeah. When I was younger, I loved photography. I still do. And I bought your book, Throb, back in 1983.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like you always had a camera with you. How were you introduced to photography?
Well, you know, through boredom, I think, because, of course, like any other normal person, I had a camera. You know, you take snapshots of your life as you go along. But it wasn't like, oh, this is an art form and I must study it. You know, that sort of, I think the actual facts of it were, we were in New York in, I think it was September 79. We were always already like the hottest band in the world. Everybody was after us. we were surrounded by photographers, lots of girl photographers. And somewhere in there, you know, I started to get interested in their equipment. I started looking at it all and thinking about it. Something occurred to me, oh, I should get a really good camera. I'm on the road. I've got all this time, you know. I mean, the only real commitment I have is getting the gig and playing, you know, a couple of hours, however many nights a week. Then there's all this downtime, you know, and particularly in the US. That's when someone went with me and I think I bought a Nikon F here, B&H in New York. And that's where it started. But, you know, immediately it became a complete obsession. You know, I was on it, you know, fast. And I started learning. I started studying photography books, talking to people. You know, I seemed to have a natural aptitude, a knack for it. Yeah, and I think as I've talked about it now, I think those seeds were sown when I was a teenager, watching all those great European black and white films. And then I had a sort of a lust for it. And so at this later stage, it all came out. And so, you know, I picked it up and off I went.
Do you think photography comes from into the same artistic nature that drives your music career, or does it exercise different creative muscles?
Well, I think you can make the argument that there's a lot of the same terms applied to music or photography. I mean, ultimately, you're looking for shape, line, melody, abstraction, in your face, whatever, you know. It's very musical, I think. And I think being a musician has very much helped me in terms of being a photographer. Because I think musically, you know, and I think somehow in the brain, in the gray matter, that works in photography too. You know, it's like not completely alien to me. You know, I mean, if you're making music, you're looking for some form of poetry, let's say, composition, ballads, you know, aesthetic judgments. Why does this work? Is this too weird? Is that too abstract? Should it be balanced with something else? So all these terms that come out of visual art completely apply to music. And I think the reverse is true. You can apply musical terms to visual arts or whatever. You know, it all comes down to music in the end. Music is the most abstract of the arts.
Your latest book, A Series of Glances, it's mostly black and white from what I've seen, but there's a beautiful color image I saw called Masks in Mexico. What do you remember about that image?
Well, I was in Mexico, and that is a very recent image, actually. That was taken within the last year. I went down to Oaxaca for a week. I got a friend to come with me. I had never been there, but I heard it was kind of a great place. And there's some incredible Aztec or Mayan, I'm not sure which one, ruins down there that's worth the trip. So we went down there for a week and, you know, we were hanging out in this more far out Mexican town, I suppose, very authentic, less touristy. It was kind of great to be there. And one Saturday afternoon, it was a bit weird. I wish I didn't play it quite right. We went out looking at something or other. And as we came back into the town later in the afternoon at about 4:30, this incredible procession was going by with all sorts of costumes. So God, I was upset because I didn't know that it was going to be going on. But anyway, I dived in amongst all the crowd. You know, so if you want to take photographs of that thing with a parade on, you have to get in the parade and go with them. Not stand at the side and watch it go by. Get in the parade, which is what I did. So I was mixed up with all this stuff. They had masks and everything. And that's really where the picture of that kid came from. And it was so exotic that it's the kind of thing that I would like.
Yeah, it looked like you were right in the thick of it.
I was, definitely, very much so. Great adventure. I mean, one thing, you know, doing photography out there in the world, it is an adventure if you're following your eye, because you're sort of semi-aware of where you're going, but not all that aware, because you're kind of following your eye through a lens, and you go down dark alleys and streets in your foreign city, and there are other people, and you don't know, is there danger there or not? So I've never really gotten hurt. I've been threatened a few times, but I use a Leica camera. And it's pretty subversive, you know. It's not like some giant, you know, telescopic thing.
Is it the same Leica that you have your own signature Andy Summers model of? Is that what you're using now?
Well, no, I mean, they made, in essence it is. It's, they made, I'm not quite sure why they did that. They made what's called an M2, it's a beautiful camera with all my design on it. But the camera I'm using, and it's not the very latest one, is the M10, which I thought, God, man, when they came out with the M10, both in color and black and white, they should sell the company now. They've reached the apex. This is it. No, they've gone on to the M11. I'm not particularly interested in going there. I'm very happy with the M10. It's you know, I know what I'm doing. You know, it's great, great camera.
Looking at your photos, it's clear that you spend a lot of time traveling, both cities and sometimes kind of far off the beaten path. And talk about some of the places, like in Africa, when you do get off the beaten path. Where have your travels taken you for photography?
Well, I've been all over the world. I've been in Tibet, for instance. I went there for a full week on my own. You know, I went to China, and I intend to go again. I've been 8 times traveling in China because I had a certain friendship with somebody that allowed me to do that, all over it, you know, far west, Tibet, all across the center. No, I never got tired of it because it's an incredible country, and it's not at all the way it's portrayed in the media, you know, which is all about Xi Jinping and the government. That's a different China than the one I know. I will always start from Shanghai, which is almost a very Western place. Yeah, it is Chinese, but it's a very exotic city. And so China is a big one for me, but I've also traveled all over South America. I've been in, there's almost nowhere I haven't been. I did another trip all across Asia through Laos and Burma and Cambodia, which was great. The Cambodian thing was pretty amazing. Angkor Wat. Been in Sahara, you know. So I've done a lot. I mean, it's almost endless. And, you know, I'm hoping if the, you know, COVID and all that crap allows it to continue on. I think I'm playing in Australia in March. And then I've got 2 photo shows in Japan. So that's going to be interesting. I think we can time it out. I might pass through Indonesia on the way up to Japan. If I can make it. I've been there before. But, yeah, we'll see. You know, it's all very interesting. I mean, working with a camera, and you're not just a tourist. You know, I think you absorb the environments and the cultures in a different way, maybe in a deeper way, because I'm really looking and trying to take it in, you know. And I'm not just trying to take pictures of somebody in a funny costume or a funny app. I'm trying to get, you know, some kind of semi-abstracted thing that kind of sums it up in a different way, which it means for better photography. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not, you're not just taking a picture of the Eiffel Tower. The photos that I really enjoy that you've shot, they're more like a National Geographic vibe, as you're focusing on these people in these other countries that you might not meet if you just go to the touristy areas.
That's right. It does bring you into different situations because you see something, you go, God, that looks great. I wonder if I could, you know, and you develop little techniques to, you know, say if you wanted to film people, and there's no reason, you know, I don't avoid people, but I don't only want to shoot people, you know, but you find techniques to approach them and do them. I mean, funny one is like going to China and traveling far out there. One odd thing that I learned was carry a pack of cigarettes in your pocket. And, you know, you approach some old guy with an incredible face or something that you would like to take a picture of. Give them a cigarette and everything changes. Immediately, they're very super friendly. They will take that cigarette and they guard it. They put it away.
Interesting. I'm not
saying that in a condescending way at all, but it was an approach that I found very useful, to be friendly. And you don't just go and take, you know, raise your camera and take a shot. You try to be nice with the people, culture. And so you want to blend in a bit and ease your way into these situations.
Did the pandemic kind of derail your recording schedule? And do you have more solo work to get done because of that?
yeah, you know, I don't even really know what happened because we record, you know, I have a studio in LA and, you know, I recorded it. And I don't really know why we stopped. I mean, I think, I don't know if I was on the road because I wasn't on the road, but somehow we just didn't get back into it, you know. And I made a lot of solo records and I have a whole storehouse of compositions I'd like to record and do more with, but I don't know, somehow that sort of three ghostly years passed us by. We were active. I'm gonna have to start looking it up because people ask me this a lot, what did you do? And I go, I don't know what I did, and I don't know how we could got through a time that was so long and protracted, because that's not me. I'm very driven, you know, driven creatively. I write, you know, I put out the book, Fretted and Moaning. I did that. I finished that off. That was probably one of the things I did. So that took time. And that's selling out every night. We sold 60 books last night when I appeared here. So, you know, that was satisfying to get that done and accomplished and put together and all that. Because all these things take a certain amount of energy. And I'm pretty involved. I don't just hand things over. I sort of tend to see it through. I put that out. I did do stuff. Let's see now. I also put out the latest photography book, which I put together, which actually, come to think of it, took 6 months. So that probably stopped us being in the studio recording. That book is a series of glances published by Tenois in Germany. That's available now on Amazon and everywhere. So that was a big project too. So right there, then I played at Lycage. Actually, now that you start mentioning it, I actually was pretty busy. Think of it, because all these things are set up. You know, you don't just you have to prepare for them. You know, those two books took a lot of time to get ready, and then maybe that wasn't the first time I'd done the solo show when I performed at Leica in Germany, but it was. It had been a while, you know, since the last one. Maybe a year had passed, and there we were. And it was a sort of heavily pressured situation. Plus, there was an exhibition, and that took putting together. So, yeah, no, I was not idle. I'm never idle, and now I'm sort of starting to remember all the things I did do. Yeah,
sounds like you can't sit still. You've
no, not really.
As we sort of wind down here, you've had such a successful music career, photography, multimedia. What haven't you done that you have an itch for that you'd like to do?
Well, I probably should swim the British Channel, but I don't know if I've got it in me anymore. I might go for a dip in the Four Seasons Minneapolis swimming pool this afternoon before I do the gig. That's about it now. I have to preserve the energy for the show. You know, I have a tendency, you know, if I get somewhere, well, now I'm in Minneapolis, to run all over the street to see whatever they've got. But, you know, that's kind of stupid on the day of the show. Dude, slow down, keep the energy. You're doing the show tonight. That's where I want to put it. So I'm not going to go mad today.
Right.
Yeah. See how it goes. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I would just love to hear what's on your merch table. You said you're selling books. Do you stay after to sign autographs and meet people, and what goes on at the merch table?
Yeah, unusual. Last night I did a book signing at this place, which is pretty famous here, called Electric Fetus. Mm-hmm. It's really a record store. They've been around forever, and you know, I don't live in Minnesota, so I wouldn't know about it, but we had a fantastic turnout and it was very lovely and warm, and they sold 60 books and we're all very pleased. But unfortunately, I think they sold out everything that was left in the US, and the English publisher is going like mad now trying to produce a softback version, because, you know, yeah, typically, you know, I do the show the night, and at the end of the night, I ask the merchandise person, how did it go? You know, sold everything. Every night we sell everything. So, man, if you want to sell merchandise, do a gig, because that's where you sell it. It's quite incredible. It's the hot moment, you know. And you know, the books sold. Every book was sold.
Fantastic.
It's a bit worrying now that we can get enough back on, you know, on the tour with us.
Nice.
Yeah.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Always a pleasure.
All right. Great. Have a good one.
All right. Cheers.